You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dearla. This episode was recorded live at the Festival Encounters 2025, curated by Van Gogh House, taking place at venues in and around Brixton, South London. I was so pleased that my guest for this episode said yes to doing this event with me, because she was the first person who came to mind when I was asked to be part of the festival. So here's a brief intro, and this is also loosely the same introduction that the guest at the event heard. Anna from Van Gogh House kind of introduces both before we start the conversation. So here we go. Joke Bakare is a Nigerian chef and founder of Chishuru restaurant in Fitzrovia. She started her business with a van outside her church in southeast London, then won a competition to win a three-month restaurant pop-up in Brixton Village. Joke is the first black female Michelin-starred chef in the UK. I was so excited to talk to Joke for lots of reasons that I'm going to get into, so I really hope you enjoy our conversation. Okay, let's get into it. Thanks so much, Anna. Thanks so much, Anna. We decided on these stools on advice from Joke's business partner, Matt, and we're going to see how it goes. Thank you so much for coming, all of you, to this live podcast recording. This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dearlove. And to tell you a little bit about Lekka, if you don't know it already. So I am really interested in, I guess, like stories of how we cook, how we eat, and what happens in our homes and kitchens to make that happen. I'm interested in the things that maybe don't get documented within private life and domestic life, things not always considered worthy of headline, but I think they're the most interesting things about food culture often. All of that is to say that I'm slightly out of my comfort zone today because I don't often interview chefs, let alone chefs of Joke's caliber and profile. But as soon as the festival approached me to do this event, I thought of no one else apart from Joke because I wanted the event to feel connected to Brixton. And as we'll get into, that is very much the case. And also, just anyone who has eaten Joke's food or been to her restaurants will understand how special she is as a chef and as somebody who understands kind of hospitality and food in general. Also, this is a very exciting moment for me. I've recorded in many places over the years, in countless home kitchens, on barges, in community centres. I've actually never done a live podcast. So thank you very much to all of you for coming. Okay, so as I mentioned, Joke was top of my list for this event. And Anna's given us a lovely bio introduction, so I won't reiterate. Okay. But I think I really want to kind of emphasise the timeline of the last few years of your career, Joke, because, so 2019, you won a competition to, after, you know, having moved to the UK from Nigeria in the late 90s, I believe, early 2000s.
Late 99, I moved in.
Late 99, yeah. And then we're going to maybe come back to some of those years in between.
Okay.
But then in 2019, you won a competition, the prize of which was a residency in Brixton Market.
Yeah.
And flash forward 5 years and you're getting a Michelin star. So that's kind of the timeline we're dealing with here. It's unusual, to say the least, I would say. Also, this is the Festival of Encounters. So I really wanted this conversation to kind of encompass the encounters of your life and how people, places and ingredients and encounters with those things have shaped your cooking and your love of food. I don't want to start right at the beginning, but okay, maybe we are going quite far back. So okay, I would love to know where your love of food started, Joke. So maybe tell us a bit about what you ate growing up and who cooked it.
I grew up in a multi-ethnic family. My dad was Yoruba from the western part of the country, and my mom was Igbo from the east. And if you are West African Nigerian, you know anything, I grew up in the north. So the food we had in the family growing up on our table was very, very multi-ethnic. So we had the twist on all the common foods that you normally have. And I was fortunate that my dad was such a lover of food. My grandfather was also a lover of food. And I kind of got my love from food for food from them. And yeah, they encouraged me to be curious.
Mm. Yeah. And in terms of, could you tell us a bit about the differences between Igbo and Yoruba food generally? Oh, just okay. For the uninitiated, what are we talking about in terms of those food cultures?
Igbo food is more, I would say, spiced. Mm. And Yoruba food is more spicy. Igbo food is more filled with aromatics and herbs. And Yoruba food is very, you'd say, very, it's plainer. It's more focused on the ingredients themselves and fermented condiments. In the north, the food is much more likened to North African food or Middle Eastern food because of the connection with religion and trade, spice trade. So it is as it's quite different wherever you are in the country. Yeah.
What was your favorite dish that your dad made?
Oh my God. He had two. One was spinach, because we love leafy green vegetables. And he would make a soup called eforiro. And his was always, it was filled with the smell of the iru, fermented iru, and it was spicy. And it was, with his own, there was much more emphasis on the vegetables themselves than the sauce that went with it. Mm. So it's like a one pot thing, but it takes a bit of skill to be able to get that thing right. And he had, another thing was egusi. His egusi was top notch, yeah.
So this is a high bar when you learn to cook. Was that who taught you to cook, your dad?
So growing up, it wasn't, oh, come and see how I put this, how I put that. It was just, you see him doing stuff and you're around there and you kind of I just picked it up by osmosis in a way.
Okay. And was there anyone else in your life kind of cooking around you that was really influential? When did you start? Did you cook at home? Is that something you started doing?
So I grew up with loads of uncles and aunties and cousins and living with us. And if they're older, they will do, they will cook if my mom is not around, because my mom had a business of her own and my dad was moving around because of postings. He was in the army. So I didn't get a chance to, but there was a time when everybody was in school and I was 8 years old, I decided I was going to make lunch for myself and my family and my siblings, and I made a mess of it. I poured it down the sink. I was trying to make amala. My nephew calls it brown jelly till today. So I was trying to make amala. And I went and it had lumps, because it was a skill for you to turn it. It's like making pate choux pastry. You have to turn it so that there's no lumps. And for my small hands, I thought, this, just put the flour. I noticed them doing it. And it was lumpy. Poured it down. Okay. At the end of it, I finished almost a box of flour. And I thought, and the thing that would have gotten me into trouble was blocking the drains. I managed not to block the drains. And my mom actually showed me how to make amala.
So yeah. What is amala? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the dish. Tell us about it.
It's a stiffened carbohydrate and it's made from a root veg. Mm. So it's made from yams, from fermented yams. And we always make our own flour ourselves. So my mom would buy yams and would cut it and ferment it and dry and ground it. And ours was really, really nice, because she didn't believe in you buying from outside. But if you buy from the shops, it's usually the peel. So it was using the whole tuber itself. So it's either you use the tuber itself or you use the peel or you use a mix of both.
Mm. Am I right in thinking you also had a love of cookbooks that started early?
Oh my God, yes.
Tell us about that.
That was a thing from my grandfather. He was very curious about things and he moved around and he wasn't very educated, but he likes books. And I got my taste of collecting from a friend, well, from him, but the first book I got was a friend of mine was traveling to the UK from Nigeria. And she just went, oh, what do you want me to get for you? And I said, oh, just get me a book. And she brought back with her Margaret Patton's Encyclopedia of Cookery, the blue one. I still have it. She got it from me, I think I was 10, 11.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, and it just transported me. I opened it up and it had with this pages of photographs of food that was so foreign to me.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God. And it was, the first one was an hors d'oeuvre and it was Horace Div for me because I didn't know how to pronounce it. Okay? And I had, there was a crepes. And my first thing that I cooked from there was a crepe. It was shit, but my dad loved it. He said, oh my God, this is so, oh, you are such cooking foreign food. So that was my very first cookbook, and I've been collecting cookbooks ever since I was 10, 11.
Yeah, that's quite a strong start, 10, 11 with Marguerite Patton. What came after that? How do you top that?
I know. I think that was further down. There was a very popular and I think iconic till today, Mrs. Williams' cookbook, it was called, or Book of Cookery. It was written by an expat living in Nigeria at that time. It was used in schools after a while, but Mrs. Williams' cookery book.
Yeah. And so that's interesting. That was Nigerian food as documented by an expat.
Yes.
Was that different from what you were experiencing at home?
It was very different because I think with anything, if you come to a place, I found out when I opened the restaurant, was you had to interact with the environment. And with the food that you find there, to be able to produce something that you're used to. I think that's what she tried to do, and that was what I was trying to do when I opened Chishuru, yeah.
Well, before we get to that, you also must have had a similar experience when you moved to the UK, right, which was long before you opened the restaurant. Can you remember what the first thing you ate on arriving in late 1999 was?
So I was just telling somebody this and I'd just forgotten about it completely. When my mom came to meet me at, I think, Heathrow, we used the Piccadilly line. I've forgotten where we changed over to the Victoria line and came out at Brixton. So Brixton was the first, because I lived up the road. I lived on Cold Harbour Lane, just Cold Harbour Lane. And my, we got bright lights of, what's the name of the big shop, the department store?
Oh, yeah, Morley's.
Yeah. I came, Morley's, the lights bright. I'm like, oh, my God. And my mom bought some spice and pepper. And we went home and we had pepper soup with yams. Mm. Pepper soup with yams. That was the very first meal that she cooked for me when I got to London.
So that must have lessened the shock slightly of arriving in this new city.
No, but I was excited. Mm. It was like things bustling and you saw people that didn't look different from you. So you didn't have the shock until,
a bit later. And did you continue cooking when you arrived in London? Did your mum let you?
No. With most people with ethnic homes, the matriarch always has a set way she cooks. Mm. And you don't mess with her kitchen if this is how she wants it. And my mom is very particular. It has to be just so. So whenever she's in the kitchen, you are just a helper. And just, even till now, I'm just a helper if she cooks. So, no, you're not messing with my mom's kitchen at all.
It's good to know your place, I suppose, no matter what you do outside of that kitchen. Yeah. And so when did you sort of start exploring your new environment in London by cooking and eating? It must have been a bit later on.
Yeah, but I do remember when we used to go, if we had family birthdays and things, it was 8 or 5 that we'd go to. But then when we moved away from Southeast and went to East London, there were some really nice places that you could go to in East London then that were like wholly Nigerian. I think we were one of the first ones that started having our places, like the Nigerian community, where you'd go and it's like a pub or whatever, and then you have versions of Nigerian food. But the thing that I remember, and it's such a shame that they've closed now, but they've been there forever, was this Cameroonian restaurant at the top of Clapton, a road in Clapton, and years gone by, and they make the best fish. Mm. So they had the form of like fish and chips. So it's either you have a potato chips or you have yam chips with fish that was grilled. And they grill it in such a way whereby it had like a really lovely crispy exterior, but inside was still quite moist. And served with this chili sauce that will blow your mind. It will be so hot. You know this kind of, have you eaten anything so hot that your ears, you can feel like, it's like in the
it's
the
like
cartoons.
It's like an hour body experience.
Where, yes, where there's smoke coming out your ears. There's a tingling at the back of your nape. And your eyes are watering and it's so painful, but it's so delicious that you can't help yourself and you're going back for more and you wait and ride that wave and goes down and you go again. That was what was.
Sounds incredible.
It was. And then you come out, you're happy, your mouth is on fire, but your head, it's opened you up, really. It was called Mbongo, or something like that. It was a Cameroonian place in Clapton. I don't know when they closed, but they were going for a long time. Mm. Yeah,
sounds amazing. I'm sad they've closed. And you've talked about how kind of central ingredients were to the food you were eating at home. You know, the leafy greens that you mentioned that your dad made, and your mum being very particular about the root vegetables she was using for the other dish you mentioned. How did that work in this new city? Do you remember there being ingredients you couldn't get hold of?
Before I opened the restaurants, yes. And for most immigrants, it was a thing whereby you'd get somebody, you're coming back home. Okay, so get another suitcase, pack this, and that, and the other. And could you go to that person and bring this specific fermented thing and go get crawfish from that specific person? My mom still does that. And we're able to get those things in until the rise of people in the community having groceries and whatever. Mm-hmm. We mainly relied on people coming back to the country and bringing stuff with them. Yeah. Mm.
But then you noticed a shift of things becoming more widely available.
Yeah. I think because a lot of us, when we first moved here, you wanted to do like proper jobs. You wanted to be a doctor, you want to be a lawyer, and nobody thought having an eatery or bakery was the thing. And I think savvy people, entrepreneurial people, saw that there was a market for it. And some people were doing it, they had other jobs and they had that as a side job. And that helped a lot of us becoming rooted to the communities that we found ourselves.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That is smart. But then it was a long time before you did that yourself. So you were doing, what were the proper jobs that you were doing in the interim?
Oh God, please. I just had to find a way. I did a couple of things that I just, and after a while it just became a drudge that you go in every time. And it wasn't really what I wanted to do. But at the back of my mind, I had this thing I wanted to have a restaurant, but I didn't know how to go about it until I decided, okay, this is it. I'm going to do this. Yeah.
Well, we will get onto that because I really want to sort of talk to you more about that gradually evolving process of opening Chishuru. But let's come back to South London because that's where we are. That's where this festival is taking place. And you've mentioned that Brixton was the first place you kind of emerged from the underground network up into the bright lights.
Yeah.
What makes Brixton such a special place to you? Does it still occupy that place for you now when you shop for the restaurant?
I still shop from Brixton. I still, most of the like the suppliers that I connected with when I had the restaurant, we still get a lot of our stuff from there.
Why do you think it's a special place? Like what makes it, that? What makes you, you know, keeping
changed,
your back
though.
Here?
It has changed from when we first moved to the UK. It changed really much. Then you had a mix of Afro-Caribbean and African shops. And now a majority of the things that we get are from, say, Peckham and stuff like that. Okay. But they're still a part of the West African community in Brixton.
Are there specific things that you come back to buy in Brixton? So what are the things you're buying in Brixton for the restaurant?
Oh, my God. So the case in point, plantain. Case in point, plantain. When we first moved to Fitzrover, it was such a palaver to get. Honestly. So we went back to getting plantain. And it had to be just so. Mm. It had to be a certain ripeness, a certain... depending, if you want to fry, it has to be a certain type of ripeness. If you want to boil, it's... And not a lot of people realize that. The suppliers that we were buying things from, the other suppliers, think that when you say plantain, they didn't know. They'll give you, some will give you like really green plantain or just not good quality plantain. And plantain for West Africans in some dishes is as integral as rice to the Japanese. Do you understand? It was very important. So for the suppliers that I had in Brixton knew this is the type of plantain that they want. There was a time that I was coming myself and I'd feel it and I'd go, see, have you seen this? This is what I want next week. For a while, it was like that. You go, make sure, and then if you leave them, they go back to their ways. But now we've kind of found the middle ground. Yeah, yeah. And it's just plantain. It just feels like it's, when you hear it, you just think, ah, oh, it's just one ingredient. But that is like, what am I saying? It's just like an emblem of all the other things that we use that people did not understand.
And has that been, have you found that, as you know, obviously you've made this shift now to Fitzrovia, like with that shift, and maybe, I don't know, maybe in a restaurant that cooks, for example, French food might be able to then find other suppliers that would deliver there easily. Has it been the case that you're still relying on kind of your original networks for those ingredients? I mean, you mentioned with plantain that that's the case.
Yes, it's still that way. I was speaking to Aji from Akoko not too long ago, and what both of us have just realized is because it's so hard, and what we have just done was get the people to be able to supply a set thing, and then we pay for delivery. And sometimes the amount of money you pay for delivery is so much that you need to be sure you have everything you need. For me, I get my things from Brixton, I get from Peckham, I get from Dalston, I get from Dagenham Heathway, from shops. And he too, that's what he does. And for us, because we're the first ones doing this, we're doing that work of trying to make the suppliers aware that there is a demand for this, there is a market for this. If you look and you're able to source good quality ones, we will be able to buy off of you. It's still a discussion, that's an ongoing discussion.
I mean, all of these kind of very specific logistical issues must have been sort of unimaginable to you when you first started thinking about opening a restaurant. I mean, you've mentioned you had this idea in the back of your head when you were working other jobs in London for a long time before it ever kind of came to fruition. When was the first time you thought it might actually become a reality?
Because the thing is, I've had it in my head for so long. It's always been percolating. So there was no time when I went, okay, now this is it. Because I've done one or two things that just kept me on this path to opening. I've done bits and pieces. I have ventured out and done stuff. It didn't work out, but still continued. So I wouldn't say I had a specific light bulb moment that went, yes, this is what we're going to do. I would say even going on the competition and winning, it still wasn't set in stone because Brixton Market just did its own thing for a long time before 2020. So yeah, it wasn't, even then, it wasn't set in stone, as I said. Yeah. I had to keep pushing and pushing until it eventually happened.
And the other things you were doing along the way that you mentioned, what were those things? I think supper clubs, right? Or pop-ups and cooking outside your church?
The first one was actually cooking outside my church, like every Sunday. There was an opportunity to feed these people that come to church, and I reached out to the pastor and I went, yeah, I could get a food van in place if we... And that was okay. It assuaged like a need that I had then for this part of me. And for years it kept going every Sunday, or when they had something special, I would do it. And after a while I thought, oh, I wanted to do something a bit more than once a week. Okay. And I did supper clubs, not a lot because it was such a lot of work. Oh my God, the logistics of having to carry your stuff to the place and cook and clear, and you had to get there at this time and you had to leave at this time. It was a headache. I did that for a few times, and then I started thinking, I really need to get a place that's a bit more stable than this. And then Brixton Market thing came up, yeah.
And what about the food that you were serving? What's been the evolution of that? So what were you making at the place, at the van at your church?
Oh, I was making meat pies. I was making Nigerian meat pies. Oh my God. I'm getting PTSD from talking about it. It was, I would make 300-400 pies.
Oh my gosh.
On Saturdays, I didn't have a Saturday for years. I would make 300-400 pies Saturday night through Sunday morning, get it there, cook, bake it and sell. And the way the people go, oh, this is a bit small for £1.50. And I'm going, hey, I've been standing for about 20 hours on my feet. Need to appreciate this.
But it's extraordinary you were selling that many. I mean, that's incredible.
Yes.
300 or 400 a week.
Yes. It was a lot of work. But it was good. But when you think about all the other things that you have to take into account for doing a business, it wasn't really well thought through. Because for me, it had to be I had to get a certain kind of flour. I had to get the mince was fine, I had to get a certain kind of potatoes and had to do a certain kind of butter. To be able to give me that crumbly crust that I wanted. Because I grew up eating. There's one thing I was talking to somebody recently about how when you move from one place and come to another, you kind of stay in like a time warp. Mm. You have a taste of what you had growing up, and that doesn't ever change, but food evolves. The people that come in from there after you've left have moved on, are doing something else. But I had in my head that vision of Mr. Big's pies that I had growing up that I wanted to recreate, and I went through different iterations, and I finally got it, and I went, this is too much. I'm not doing it anymore.
On to the next. And so the first kind of incarnation of Chishuru, was it always a really clear vision of how you wanted the menu to look, how you wanted the restaurant to look? That first restaurant that you opened in Market Row as a result of winning the competition, was that a clear vision that you had, or was it trying something out as well?
No, it'd always been what I wanted to do. Mm. Because I kind of appreciated the fact that I grew up in this multi-ethnic household and our food was a melding of everywhere we came from. And I really appreciated that. And I wanted to share it. My Nigerian friends that come to the restaurant, to my house when I cook, we go, I know this, but this is really different. Your own take on it is quite different. And you should share this with people. So I thought, yes, it was a celebration of, I don't want to say Nigerian culture. I want to say celebration of West African culture. And I had that in mind, and I had, because by this time I loved food so much, and I knew that to be able to connect with the other communities here, I had to present it in such a way whereby people can interact with it. So I knew we don't have to do a one pot thing because it is possible. Mm. It's not making it different. Not elevating it. But making it that it is approachable and also making people that are from where I come from to see that, you could think about the food in this way, which is slightly different from what you thought about it growing up.
Yeah, there's a familiarity, but it doesn't have to be exactly the same as
no,
what they
it, do. It hasn't. Yeah. It doesn't have to be like you slavishly following a thing.
And so you then went from, you know, wanting to do cooking in a bit more of a fixed location way to getting what you wanted. How did it feel at that point when you first opened that kind of initial incarnation of the restaurant?
Oh, my God. Because at this time, it was such a lot that I've gone on in the background for me opening that it was just, okay, people just come. And it was in the middle of a pandemic. Mm. A lot of things has happened.
So September 2020.
I think on the 8th, I think it was. A lot of things had happened then. And you just thought, please, people, come. We had the help out to eat out thing and all of that. And we couldn't benefit from it because we opened later. But seeing all of that and hoping that people will still come out, because it was such an uncertain time, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, truly a wild time to open your first restaurant.
It was. But I think the appointed time. I keep saying to people that if I think if I hadn't opened them, because of what has happened was what kept me going. Mm. Like, who would have thought that something that would happen that would close down the world for months, the whole world for months on end? Mm. And you think, if that can happen, this can happen. And yeah. So I think that's what gave me the, you know, the push to go, you know what, anything can happen. Yeah. So, yeah.
And what was kind of the encounters that you had with people like in that early, in those early days in the restaurant? Was it what you expected? Like, how were people responding to the food you were cooking?
It was really, really, if I say surprising, then it means I didn't have faith in the food. No, but it was really heartening. Heartening is the word I want to use. That people were able to connect with this, will see what it is that I'm going. And at the same time, we'll go, oh my God, we didn't know that we're living adjacent to this all along, and you've made us aware of this. It's almost like we brought the food out away from the margins and bringing it into collective awareness. So I just felt really proud. I want to say proud to be part of that movement to go, okay, it's not just your mom and pop shop anymore. Mm. We can do something whereby it's a melding of the different things that we see here that makes it something slightly different, but at the same time, real.
Mm. Yeah. And what was it like? I mean, I feel like, and we had a conversation about this the first time we met, but I also used to work in a cafe in Brixton in Market Row. And I find, and this was, you know, going back 10, 15 years, but it's such a specific community, even among the business owners. How did you find that? What was kind of going on around you in the market at that time?
Oh, gosh. It's like a community. Mm. We had, you knew everybody. People were very friendly. You knew everybody. It was nice. Mm. It was nice. It was a really lovely, warm community. And everybody, as I said, everybody helped each other out.
Yeah. And then, so how did that feel moving from that kind of almost more close-knit environment to Fitzrovia, which feels like suddenly a whole different ballgame, right? What was it like suddenly being in this completely different setting, which is maybe less of a community? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, true. I really tried to stay in Brixton. But we couldn't find a place in the market then. Mm. And we found a place in Central. We wanted to be able to do lunchtime trade. We didn't have lunchtime trade in Brixton. And that was hard. And I wanted not to be open 7 days a week. Mm. I wanted to be open 5 days a week. And it just made business sense. And the price that we were quoted in Brixton was just slightly, and I mean slightly less than we found when we moved.
Wow.
Because the site we went to wasn't, nobody really wanted it. Mm. It wasn't, and we wanted something bigger. Mm. And it just kind of happened. It happened, yeah.
And how has it changed, I guess, the people that are eating with you? Do you feel like the restaurant has a different feel now you're in Fitzrovia?
No, I think the people that used to come when I was in Brixton came in the early days before we got the star. Mm. And there was still, because when we went Brixton, it was £45. Mm. Obviously, we had to take into account that we're paying higher rents and all of that, and it was £65. Obviously, you get a couple of people that would kick off against it. Mm. But we do realise that. We still have people who come to us that may come into us from Brixton. So, yes, we still kept a part of that. The only shift in how people viewed us was when we got the star and people thought that we'll be one thing and we're not. Mm. In the early days, a lot of people thought that you will be like a traditional Michelin starred place where everybody was like uptight and everything. And not everywhere is uptight, sorry. But a lot of people felt that there had to be a couple of things that we ticked off to be termed Michelin starred place. We didn't have white tablecloths. We had an amazing front of house person that greeted you. And we were different. Mm. We were not that kind of place. We're very laid back. We didn't take ourselves too seriously. It was all about the kind of hospitality we gave when we were in Brixton. Mm. And yeah.
Well, that was moving on to my next question. You know, as we mentioned in the intro, 2024 saw you get the Michelin star as the first Black woman in Britain to do so, which is an incredible achievement, but it's also sad that it kind of took this long, right? It's a bit of a double-edged sword. How did it feel to get that? Was it a shock?
Oh, gosh, it was, because we didn't know. We got this invitation and it was like a week or 2 weeks before. And it says,
so this is before the ceremony.
Before the ceremony. I just said, oh, you're invited to the Michelin ceremony in Manchester. And I thought, oh, okay, because we just opened. So they're trying to get loads of like new restaurants in. Oh, that's nice. And that's nice. We have, we'll drink champagne and you know, hobnob with the rest of them. And I said to Matt, I went, what do you think we won? He said, oh, come on, don't be ridiculous. Of course not. I went, oh, okay. They didn't say anything. So we're going to go. We went. And I saw my friend Charlie from Owlis. And I went, hey, man, well done. So it means you won. Oh, ow. We don't know what's going on. And he went, oh, there might be something in there for you. And I thought, are you sure? I'll get away. And that was how it was. We just patted him on the back. And the ceremony people did not make it easy as well. They'd call like 15, 16 other people. And all men, all white apart from Ayo. And then they went, okay, and this is the class of 2024, the new one star, da-da-da-da. Can we get the head of this to come on before everybody comes on stage and takes a picture? And he comes on and he goes, before we have a picture, we have one last thing. And it was like a game show thing. Like, aha, you won. And then he went, and the other Michelin is for the West African food. She, and I just jumped up. Initially, I went, fuck. Me and Matt just looked at each other. Initially, we were thinking, okay, this is, Matt was going, okay, we look like numpties just sitting here. And I thought, you know what, don't worry. We're just going to have the champagne and we're all going to go home tonight if we have to. And then that came up, and then I just jumped. And if you'd seen videos of me, it was like I was going around and going, okay, where should I go? Somebody was just like moving me about because I was in shock.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we never planned it. We never went, okay, we're going to get this place and we're going to do this and do that. And people that opened up at that time, you'd see a restaurant that wants to get Michelin. You know, you see all the things they do. They tick all those boxes. And we're not even aware of it because
we had enough on your plate.
Yeah, it was. Yes. And yeah, it was quiet. And then we just sat down all through this. After the ceremony, we just sat down, just looking at each other, looking at, okay, that happened now, did it? Okay, it did happen.
It's really funny to hear this story because I've seen the video of you going on stage and kind of accepting the jacket and saying, and you look cool as a cucumber.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So it was obviously was all internalized before you got on stage. And what about after that? I mean, how do you kind of then go back to what you were doing before? Did it feel really different after that had happened?
Oh, yes, it did. The first couple of weeks, we got people that knew us or people that wanted to try it. Come in and it was really nice. But then we started getting people from that had a set mind of how it's supposed to be and we're not like that. And there was a period where I thought, okay, do we do this? And we did, and I went, it's like putting on a jacket that wasn't yours, and it quickly we changed. We had some people who'd come and go, oh my God. And you could see it on their face. Oh, how did these people get? Look, they know this, they didn't do this, they didn't do that. And you could see them go, and there was nothing you could do that could change their mind because we were not that look. We didn't look it at all. And we didn't aspire to look like that. We're just ourselves, and we were like, this is what we're cooking. It was, yeah.
So what did you try and then swiftly go back on?
Oh God, we tried to do mini D's. Which wasn't it. We are trying to celebrate our culture, and one thing I've noticed is people that were colonized. We look at everything that we do, our food especially, through the lens of the people that colonized us. And you try, and no matter how I see it in like some Asian food, whereby it is the level of skill and everything, but you still see them trying to look at their food through the lens, through the French gastronomic lens. And I think that's what I was doing, trying, okay, this is what it is, this is what is accepted, okay, let's look at it through this. But then it felt really false.
Yeah. It's just everywhere though, isn't it? The language of the kitchen is, yes. You know, so much of it is rooted in that kind of like colonial legacy, often French language as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did that feel like a tension for a while, and then you kind of broke free of it again?
Yes, it was. It was. I just thought, no, let's just be ourselves. And what we just needed to do was just to constantly set a bar for ourselves and just improve that. But at the same time, be the back of my mind, just be rooted to say, how true to the culture is this? How true to the food is this? And I have used different ingredients just to create different flavor profile and change the food a bit, added a different dimension to it. But always at the back of my mind, it had to still be rooted to where it came from, had to still be rooted in the food of the region.
Yeah. And ultimately, you get to be the final judge of that, I feel, in this case.
Yeah, but more than anything, I wanted to be true to it. Because even with us, we're not writing about our food as much before, but now, thank God, there are people writing more about it. We're not documenting it. And I just felt this responsibility to, if people come after me to cook it, let us have a yardstick.
And because I've heard you say in interviews before that you really, you find that when people use the word elevated around your food, you don't like that. You kind of I've heard you push back on it. And I'm interested to know, what is it about that phrasing or that kind of framing of your food as jarring? And how would you like people to talk about it instead?
When you use the terminology elevated, then it connotes that the food itself is it has no value the way it is.
It needs to be raised up.
Yeah. But it doesn't need to be raised up, and that's the reason why. And because obviously, with what we're doing, there's techniques and skills that goes into it, and I think that should be celebrated as well. It could be something different. I can acknowledge that. But for you to say whatever we're doing is elevated, it's not. It's just we're cooking food in such a way to be accessible to people here, to the community that I'm a part of, to my adopted land. So that is what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to... The food on its own, it's sophisticated enough. So it doesn't need somebody else to come and say, oh, I'm bringing it up from this low level to this, no.
I love that you used kind of the idea of the white tablecloth as a kind of like shorthand for what is often the expected kind of both aesthetic and atmosphere of a Michelin-starred restaurant. And I think anyone who's been to Chishuru knows that that is so extremely not the vibe. And not only is, you know, the food incredible and like the kind of generosity of the way things are served to you is wonderful, there's also just this incredible atmosphere. It's true hospitality in the kind of every sense of the word. Is that really important to you as well as the food, the kind of how people come in and feel in the space?
It's been one of the things that I have insisted on. When we opened in Brixton, it was that when you come in, we want you to feel the hospitality that you feel in, I believe, in a West African home when you go in, when they believe that the guest is king. So that's the mindset that I use to approach the type of hospitality that we provide when people come in. Yeah.
Because I think that it was really apparent, just, you know, your incredible front of house staff, that just like every single person is so knowledgeable and so lovely. Like, oh, it's amazing. Lovely. Is it a big part of the kind of training and like, I don't know, how do you kind of instill what you're doing in everyone? Or is it more of a natural process?
It's more of a natural process, I think, because most of the guys that we have working with us, the team are just, they're just very enthused about what we're doing. And the knowledge that Matt was really good at that as well, just getting them up to speed. Because sometimes I kind of just go off on a tangent when I'm explaining it to them, but he's able to bring it down and he's able to break it down for them. So, and they just really love it. So I don't know about other people. I think in that aspect, I'm really, really, really blessed to have such a wonderful team working with me. Yeah.
So you've mentioned how kind of the food that you now serve in the restaurant kind of began for you cooking for friends at home, for guests at home. And you've kind of gone from zero to 100 in that sense. You've gone from cooking like really as a hobby or as like a love or a side project to being a Michelin-starred chef. How has it changed what you cook at home? Do you cook at home now at all?
I do cook at home once in a while because I cook
at the weekends.
Because anybody that lives alone, it's so hard to cook for yourself. It's really hard to cook for yourself. So once in a while, I just get, hey, do you want to come down? Then I've been told I go into hostess mode and I put things out, yeah.
Because was cooking at home previously a kind of site of experimentation and playing around for you, and it's maybe you have the restaurant for that now?
No, cooking at home for me, I say it then, was a way that I showed love to the people close to me. Mm. And it was... There is definitely that bit of me that needed that creative outlet. But it was a way of showing love. It was a way of coming together, of community for me. And that was what I carried through to the restaurants, especially when we opened in Brixton. Mm. And even now. So, yeah, I think that was what it is.
Yeah. What do you cook for yourself when nobody's looking?
What do I cook for myself when nobody's looking? I do... really quick things. I could do a stir fry. I do a nice curry. The thing is, I move. It's either between West African food and South Asian food. Mm. That's it depends on how I feel at that time. Because in many ways, I feel they've got the same flavor profile. So yeah, it is. I know. I did not realize that until I started. And a lot of people will go, oh, this is very familiar to me, but it's just different. But because I feel we've got the fermented fish, we've got the fermented condiments, the spice, the aromats and whatever. And if you have the base of that, I think regardless of what you put on top of it, there will always be that thread that is connecting through the cuisine itself.
Mm. Yeah. That's so interesting. So, Jocke, you've been called a trailblazer for Nigerian food. There is obviously a very strong and significant Nigerian community in the UK and many food shops, restaurants, cooks and chefs flying the flag for the country, but it isn't necessarily respected or celebrated or even just kind of visible in mainstream food culture in the way that it should be. Who would you consider a trailblazer or somebody that everybody should know about when it comes to Nigerian food?
Ooh. In the UK?
Either. You're cool.
Oh, gosh. When it comes to Nigerian food, I would say the person that really got me thinking more about food was Ozor Soko. Mm. Kitchen Butterfly, it's her Instagram. Mm. And she's quite knowledgeable about West African food and how it is and all of that. So she got me into looking more at the food that I ate and thinking about it a bit more. But another person that I think got me trying to connect with the food here slightly differently was Shalina Pomelo. Mm. When she won the MasterChef thing, and an African doing that and doing the food that she grew up with, doing it like that, for me, it just opened me up even that bit more to go, oh my God, so you could do African food like this. You could be, there could be a starter, main and a thing. And yeah, those, I would say those two women, Ozor's Nigerian food and Shalina African food. Mm. Yeah.
And was there anyone, you know, you've mentioned the kind of cookbooks that you're into and the people around you and your immediate family, but when you were younger and you were first learning to cook, is there anyone you remember kind of seeing that was a real inspirational influence on you?
I think in the 80s, there was this woman, Auntie Wendy Media or something, I've forgotten her name now. She had a TV program and was a cook. She was our Fanny Craddock, I think. She was...
So this is on Nigerian TV.
Yes, she was so good. And she did it. She did Nigerian food with, I wouldn't say elevated, but...
You can't, you're not allowed.
I can't. But the program had just doing that, which really excited me. But another thing was my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, used to make street food, not sell. She'd make it in bulk and then sell it off to people who'd sell it. So both of them were really kind of pivotal to how I viewed food and how, yeah, when I was growing up.
Yeah, I see all the different potentials of what cooking could bring you. So, final question. The name of your restaurant, Chishuru, means to eat silently in Hausu. I found this so interesting to learn because it's such a familiar concept to me. Like, I think anyone who's been at a table when something delicious has been served, there is this silence that descends, but there isn't a word for it in English. Are there any other untranslatable words that you know that you that relate to food that you love?
Oh, God. I should think about it, but... We call things because of the way they sound in your mouth, and I'm sure loads of languages have that. With stockfish, we'd call stockfish okporoko, and that just means the sound it makes when it falls. so it just would when it falls, and those kind of things. Yeah, I never really thought about it. And somebody was saying recently about chop and whatever. No, I don't. No. If we like something, we'd call it twice. Puff, puff instead of puff. and chin, chin instead of just one. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What made you select Chishuru as the name?
So the restaurant, when I started, when the thought came, and this was years before I entered the competition. This was like early noughties that I had Chishuru. I wanted all the different parts of me to appear. So my Igbo part, which was in the logo, the CBD logo, which means... I'm a person from different waters. There it was different waters. I'm from different waters, but one. The Yoruba aspect in the colors and whatever. And then the Hausa, which is not a lot of people, if you hear my name, because your name, if somebody tells you who, if you say, oh, what's your name? And you tell somebody from Nigeria, they know exactly where you come from. If you tell them your surname, they know exactly where that is. So I wanted... that bit of my heritage also to show. That's why I looked for a thing called a thing that would fit it. And in house, it was between Senti and Chishuru. Senti means it's so delicious. It's so delicious that you kind of you become flawed and you sit and
that's a great one.
When somebody says senti and then another person says asawaji, it means if you say oh senti, you said oh can you put a wedge on them so that they don't fall. So I just thought it was too much to explain, but my mind, it's very convoluted. I'll get there in the end. And there was a beans that I like in Hausa, in the north, which is like, it's like an Adzuku beans, small, and it gives you, there's a mouthfeel that it gives, and we call it a Chishuru. And then also there was Chishuru. And then I thought, do you know what? A Chishuru, Chishuru. Let me do Chishuru. Yeah.
And the double meanings. And the double meanings.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Jockey, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
All right.
You.
I can do a little. Thank you. Yes. Please clap, Jockey. Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you for coming to this live podcast recording of Lekka. If you've enjoyed what you heard, you can subscribe in your favourite podcast app. This interview will also be available to listen shortly. And thank you so much to Dr.
Thank
Bakare.
It's
been such
me.
A pleasure talking
thanks
to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Go and eat at Chishuru if you haven't. It's incredible. Other thank yous. Thank you to Van Gogh House for having me at the festival. Thank you to Anna and Alicia for organising this amazing programme in particular. And if you stick around, Bea Wilson is happening next, and then Lewis Bassett talking about English food later on, and that's going to be great. And thank you so much to all of you for coming as well. Thank you.